afternoon, America. Welcome to This is Mark Levine. Today, I just got an hour with you. So in my hour, I was thinking a lot about war because we're getting close to going to war in the Middle East again against ISIS. And I've been thinking about what wins wars and what does not win wars. There was a wonderful retrospective in the Washington Post on the Civil War, which, of course, it celebrates its 150th year of memorial. And this is about the time of Sherman's March to the Sea. That actually occurred in November of 1864, 150 years ago, and minus a couple months. And the article really explains well, I think, one of the reasons, one of the main reasons why the Union won the war. And I was also recently at Gettysburg at watching that battlefield. I think that history has a lot to teach us. And when I look at other conflicts around the globe, what's going on in Ukraine, specifically what's going on with ISIS, I think it's important to remember one main theme of war that I'm going to talk about in this hour. And that is that the people that win either win by overwhelming force, which happens in some cases, or they win because they have more to fight for. And when it comes to any close war, when it comes to any real, you're not sure which way it's going to go, the people who have more to fight for win. And the people who are demoralized lose. And I would say we saw that during the Civil War, as well as the recent war when Russia is invading Ukraine, and Ukraine is basically surrendering, to how to fight ISIS. So let me go through some of these things today. And by the way, you don't have to agree with me. If you disagree or agree, either way, I'd love to have you call in at 888-653-7543. Let's talk, first of all, about the Civil War. Now, I don't usually go this far. Well, I like history. I don't usually go this far back in history, but I've been known to talk thousands of years of history. So let's just go back 150 years and take a look at what was going on in the United States of America at that time. It is a good time to remember the Civil War on its 150th anniversary. And going into the election of 1864, there was a real question of whether Abraham Lincoln would win or not. In fact, he wrote a sealed letter to his cabinet basically saying that he expected to lose. In fact, his Secretary of State, William Seward, said that his reelection was impossible. He expected to lose to basically a peace candidate by the name of George McClellan. He was an officer in the Union Army who wanted to basically sue for peace, let the southern states go. And Lincoln was basically saying in his letter that I know I'm going to lose, but I'm going to keep fighting until the last day I'm in office. Because in those days, the inauguration occurred on March 4th. Election in November, so he would have still had five more months to fight, and he made clear that he was going to keep fighting. And he basically gave a lot of leeway to his commanders to fight really hard. William Tecumseh Sherman was a demon in the South. He was known for great cruelty. Interestingly, and of course, Sherman's March to Sea was pretty devastating and burning down Atlanta and basically cutting a swath of miles long, all the way from Tennessee through Georgia, all the way down to Savannah, and then up into South Carolina. But Sherman understood that his reputation for basically being all about destruction was more powerful in some ways than the actual destruction. Indeed, while his troops did certainly steal some food and some livestock all throughout, one of the things that this article points out is that Sherman's destruction was actually not as severe as historians pretended to be, as the South pretended to be. It was pretty bad. There was a lot of desolation, but it wasn't random, massive killing of people other than the troops. It was mostly taking the stock and the food. This was actually a new technique in wartime because it used to be that you really had to protect your supply lines. This is one of those things I learned at Gettysburg. that the reason why the South didn't go further north and take Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and other important places, the capital of the Union's most populous state, was because they had to protect their supply lines all the way down to the South. Well, Sherman broke free of supply lines and basically took all the food in Georgia. I am getting, by the way, to how this is relevant to today. I promise. This is not just a history lesson. I plan to conclude discussing Ukraine and ISIS and explaining it all in one context. But what Sherman understood was that in order to get the South to stop fighting, it could not be seen as this gallant effort the way the original fighters in the Civil War were. If you've studied the Civil War, you know that in 1861, that the fighters of the North and the South, particularly in the South, for whom fighting was an art form, indeed, Southerners were very good at it. There were more Southerners at West Point than Northerners. That's one of the reasons why they won a lot of the early battles. They knew the chess game of war, how to conduct a war in terms of the best way to position your troops. It's very hard for troops that are as outgunned as the South. I mean, the North had three times the population of the South, so it's very, very hard for the South to win that war. But there was a gallantry of it. They would go see Gone with the Wind, and really that was how people saw it. It wasn't necessarily true, but it was how the war was seen. Saddle up on your horse, go out, defend Southern honor, which of course meant slavery, but for them that was a good thing. And it was a way, you know, and actually the women, this is one of the funniest things about the Civil War, funny, laughable, but also funny, strange, and also funny, disturbing, is that a lot of the women of the South in the early battles would go up onto the Virginia hilltops and have a picnic and watch the battle below, almost like we would watch a sporting event. They would sit on their hilltops and sip their lemonade and watch as, you know, their husbands or sons would be brutally fighting in the war. And there was one point where the war came up the hill and the women were incredibly disturbed that their tea party was ruined as they had to run for their lives so that the war didn't shoot them. Initially, war has a certain gallantry. World War I, very famous for this. Everyone thought it'd be over in a matter of months, and everyone thought they would win. Austria would punish Serbia, and Russia and France would punish Germany and Austria, and then Germany would punish France by going through Belgium, and then England would punish Germany by defending the neutrality of Belgium, and before you know it, you have 4 years of the most brutal war at that time in human history. Trench warfare, chemical weapons used, true brutality, and basically would have been a stalemate, except for things like the Russian Revolution and the American entry into the war. The point is, the way I think to win a war is to study war's past. Now, not the technology. Obviously, we have F-16s now. We have planes. They didn't have those in the Civil War. So I'm not so much saying that we need to copy their technology. But the psychology of war, I don't think, changes much. And when Sherman marched to the sea in his campaign of destruction, it was very much saying, look, we are powerful. He said, I'm going to make Georgia howl, and I'm not going to make war seem romantic anymore. It's going to be brutal. And we are very much going to take people's property and make life really, really hard for them. In fact, they had a pattern of burning down barns, burning livestock so that people wouldn't have the food to eat that they would otherwise have, or taking that food for themselves. There's actually a interesting, funny story. Again, funny being a weird word, but that I was reading about in the Washington Post about these farmers in the South who knew that Sherman was coming and knew they had a pattern of burning barns and basically destroying food or taking the food for themselves. And so this clever Southerner and his wife decided to set out a feast for the invading troops. And they had a beautiful setup in the best of Southern tradition, a beautiful setup table with designs and a way to basically put all the food out there so that they could have a nice sumptuous feast. and some of their best food and so forth. And when the Union troops came, the commander in charge said, you know, I thank you, that's very sweet, but I can't eat your food because then we'd feel bad about burning your barn because we have orders to burn down your barn. And the Southern gentleman certainly had the right idea. He said, you know, go ahead and eat, and then if you have to burn down my barn, burn down my barn. But, you know, this is our hospitality. So the Union troops ate the big feast, and when it was done, the commander said, well, you know, we're not required to burn down empty barns. And they all looked at the farmer's barn full of corn and food and livestock and said, well, we all agree it's empty, and they left. Great story. True story. Story about the psychology of war. I bring all this up because in fighting ISIS, we need to understand their psychology. We need to know where they're coming from in order to know how to defeat them. The same goes, by the way, with Ukraine and Russia. And I would argue that war is often won by the people with the least to lose, by the people who are up against the wall, by the people who feel they're going to die anyway. You want to know how the Vietnamese beat the United States? It wasn't because of our firepower. We had far more firepower than Vietnamese, but they were fighting at home. They were fighting in their own territory. They felt they had nothing to lose. Whereas the South, while fighting at home and in the South, they had to lose a whole way of life, of slavery and plantation and ease, relying on the brutality they were doing to others, to the slaves. But yet they knew that they would still be part of the nation. They still had a connection to the North. There was still something to lose that they didn't want to lose. And Sherman basically said, look, you're going to get complete destruction unless you surrender. When I come back from break, I want to tell you how I apply these lessons to ISIS, to Ukraine, to the whole Middle East, to the way the conflict is going, because we have to understand how to win a war if we're ever going to choose to fight a war. If you have any questions, please give me a call at 888-653-7543. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. United States Congress is about to vote on whether or not to approve President Obama's plan to take on ISIS, or what Obama calls ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or the Islamic State in the Levant, which is a fancy old name for the Middle East. In order to fight these people, I think we need to understand who they are. I think that it's very easy to characterize them as terrorists, and they are terrorists. Of course they're terrorists. I'm not denying they're terrorists. All you have to do is watch some of the beheading or what they did to the people, the Yazidi people, basically trying to wipe them out. They're evil, awful people. But just because they're evil and awful doesn't mean that there isn't a reason they're fighting, and doesn't mean that we should understand why they're fighting. Because if we don't understand why they're fighting, we're never going to defeat them. So who is ISIS? Who are the people fighting, and why have they taken over so much of Iraq and Syria, countries that, well, we were in charge of Iraq for several years, but prior to us invading, the countries were both stable countries, controlled by dictators to be sure, but stable countries. So who are the people who are fighting in ISIS, and then why do they have so much power today? Let's deal with the second question first. Why is ISIS so much in power? If you look at world history, you see that countries and states and populations gain power generally when the other places around them are weak. That's when you find these relatively small number of people. There's probably only 10 to 15,000 ISIS fighters a year ago. There may be 30 to 50,000 now. It's a relatively small number compared to, say, the hundreds of thousands in the Iraqi military. But you see, we have failed states. Syria is a complete failed state because its dictator Assad set about massacring the vast majority of its people. Assad is a Shia Muslim, specifically what's called an Alawi. That's a sect of Shia Islam. The majority of people are Sunnis. And Assad wants to keep in power, like all dictators. And when the people did a very peaceful, really pacifist, marches to demand that they have a say as part of the Arab Spring in their government, he mowed them down. He started shooting them in mass numbers. And when they kept going there before in the Syrian capital and shouting things like peaceful, peaceful, and putting roses in soldiers' guns, the soldiers would shoot them. I guess that probably destroyed the rose as well. As of today, there are 200,000 Syrians murdered by their own government. Now, this is, if you've listened to me before, you know this has been a concern of mine for a long time. I argued 3 years ago that we could use a no-fly zone to help the Syrian people overthrow their government. And I said, if we don't, this vacuum will cause worse people to come in. Well, again, this isn't about I told you so, but it is something I did say, and it has happened. Assad, having murdered 200,000 Syrians, having exiled a third of the population of Syria, 7 million people of a country of 20 million people, exiled internally or externally in camps all over the region, Syria doesn't exist as a country. It is a hollowed-out shell, and it was fighting a moderate group of rebels called the Free Syrian Army who begged for our support and largely did not get it. And these are nothing like ISIS. So when you have a failed state, and I'm going to get to why Iraq is a failed state after the break as well, you see how these fighters move in. Most of them from foreign countries, trying just like the Southerners to fight a nice gallant war for their principles and really not facing much destruction. We'll talk about how to win this war when I come back. If you want to call in and add your 2 cents, agree or disagree, 888-653-7543. This is Mark Levine, back after this. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. 150 years ago, Sherman, William Tecumseh Sherman, general of the Union Army, did his march to the sea. I'm going to make Georgia howl, he said, and howl it did. Indeed, the South would teach for a century or more about the brutality of Sherman in his march to the sea. But he destroyed more than various farms and cropland and food and devastation, burning down Atlanta. Pretty extreme. He destroyed the South's will to fight. And it's no coincidence that a few months after Sherman's march to the sea, General Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia after the most brutal, bloody war in American history. What are we to learn from this conflict 150 years ago, using very different weapons, the weapons of the time, and thousands of miles away or rolled away from the Middle East? I think we delude ourselves into thinking that we are so different from these people on the other side of the world. They don't think like us. They're not rational like us. No, of course they are. Of course they are. People aren't that different. The weapons of war have changed. The psychology of war is not that different. Why is ISIS powerful now? It's powerful because everyone else is weak. It's powerful because we have Assad massacring his own people. And Assad very much concentrated his military on the Free Syrian Army because he knew that the free people of Syria, the Sunni majority, the people who were professors and teachers and shopkeepers and accountants and farmers and ordinary people, that they had legitimacy. They could rule and they could take over. And he actually encouraged Islamic extremists to come in. He actually helped ISIS come to power because he knew that then he could tar the legitimate rebel forces with these wild, wacko, crazy Islamic extremists and then say, come on, world, support me. I'm still concerned, by the way, that that's what's going to happen. Syria, which is financed by Iran, gives it all its military, and Russia, if we end up at the end of the day helping Assad by fighting ISIS and helping Iran and helping Russia, we will be worse off than merely having ISIS rule and doing nothing. I'll come back to that. Because Syria was no longer a state, groups like Al-Qaeda, its local name is al-Nusra in Syria, and this more extreme group, ISIS, could move in, helped by Assad, and Assad, again, wanted to use them to tar the legitimate Syrian opposition, and also because they are indeed Sunni extremists, and they are going to fight to the death, many of them. That's what they care about. Now let's move to Iraq. Iraq is another country where its central government was not ruling over its people. The Kurds have formed a separate state, and I like the Kurds. I support an independent Kurdistan. The Kurds are pro-American. They're democratic. They're a peaceful people trying to protect their territory, and I believe in autonomy, particularly for peoples without a state, like the Kurds. There is no independent Kurdistan. There's not a single country on earth that allows Kurdish language and culture to be practiced freely, and that includes our ally Turkey, part of NATO. But the Kurds were controlling an area of Iraq. Okay, this isn't about the Kurds. It's mostly about the remaining two peoples, the Sunni and the Shia. And Iraq is the reverse of Syria. For a while, Saddam Hussein was a Sunni leader controlling a mostly Shia state. Then they got a prime minister under American rule. He won the majority, so the Shia won the majority. And Maliki basically helped only the Shia. So the Sunni got mad. And so the Sunni people, and this would include some of the former Saddam Hussein folks who wanted power again, and just Sunni tribal leaders, said, we don't want a Shia government, so we will also help the ISIS extremists. Heck, they're taking on Maliki. They're taking on Shias. We like that. Just like Assad supported ISIS. We like that because they're taking on my opponents, the Free Syrian Army. So the weakness of the central states, Syria and Iraq, helped build up this group, ISIS, until it became so powerful that actually Assad's nervous about them, and so are the Sunnis in Iraq. So I promised to tell you who are the people fighting for ISIS. Who are they? Some of them, a good part of them, and indeed virtually everyone from the West, and there are Europeans there, there are even a few Americans there, are what I would call thrill seekers. People who think war is cool. Really not that different from those, quote, gallant, unquote, Southerners who boarded their horses and went off to fight a war for Southern liberty and their ladies in petticoats and, of course, to keep their slaves. They are people who need a life, and they found one. Maybe they were in trouble at home. Maybe they're pure psychopaths. Maybe they played a little too many violent video games. Probably they got a screw loose, but it's really, they're adventure seekers. And that's happened throughout American history, throughout world history, throughout human history. There's always going to be, we all know who they are, right? The people out for a thrill. The people living on the edge. If we all do it a little bit. Hey, I play poker. You know, I live on the edge in some extent. That's different from fighting a war, but you get the point. We all, you know, we bungee jump, we jump out of planes, we go surfing, right? There's a little bit of adventure, and it's men, it's not women, it's young men who need something to give their lives meaning. A lot of men that go off to war want something to give their lives meaning. If you read the old Civil War diaries, it's fascinating reading the distinction between the soldier that writes in 1861, and the exact same soldier that writes in 1864. In 1861, the 23-year-old is hot under the collar and can't wait to go to war and shoot the damn Yankees or the damn rebels, and can't wait for their first battle. 3 years later, they're sick of war. War is hell. Sherman has made sure war is hell. And the brutality and devastation and death just leaves them wanting anything but war. So some of the ISIS people, they're the true believers. Okay? the thrill seekers, I should call them. Then there are the others that are the true believers. The, you know, we want to establish an Islamic state. These would be like, you know, the real Nazis in Germany, as distinct from the rest of the German army, or the people who will fight to the death, who truly believe all the rhetoric. I would argue those are a relatively small number. We pretend like they're everybody. We pretend like they're the one, you know, they're the ones who might do the most brutal things. But there are people who believe that this is an authentic religious obligation, that this is what they are designed to do. Again, I would argue those are a relatively small number. And then there are the people who are playing the sides, right? The people who are with Assad to destroy ISIS, or they're with Sunni Iraqis. Maybe they're the ex-Saddam Hussein people, or they're the or they're tribal leaders who want to fight the Shia, people who have other motivations. They want to help ISIS, not because they want an Islamic caliphate, but they're being practical. They're saying, Assad's saying, if I help the Islamic caliphate, then I protect my own power because I defeat the Free Syrian Army, right? Iran and Russia saying, well, we'll help these people because they're fighting people we don't like, the American-trained Iraqi army, the free people of Syria. So we'll build our little Frankenstein's monster there, and it'll attack people we don't like. And lo and behold, it's attacking us. My point is that I don't think ISIS is that strong. I really don't. I think they're there because of the weakness of Iraq and Syria, because the Iraqi and Syria governments were not only not taking care of their population, they were actively harming their own populations. And because they had some very cynical protection by enemies of ours. Here's the heart of what I'm trying to say. The real demon in Syria is not ISIS. It's Assad, the dictator Assad. The real problem in Iraq is not ISIS. It's prime ministers like Maliki, thank God he's gone, and thank God Obama pushed him out, who only saw Iraq as a way to protect one group of people, not small, the majority, but to protect the Shias at the expense of the Kurdish and Sunni minorities. It's the failed states that's the cause of ISIS. And if we only defeat ISIS, if we only send bombs in to attack this relatively small group, without their support by the cynical leaders, is just a bunch of thrill seekers and a few, relatively few fanatics, we won't have solved anything at all. The only way to fight an ideology is to give people hope that there's something after that ideology. The Syrian people are pushed against the wall. They are being massacred. There are bombs that are being dropped that are the size of Dempsey dumpsters, wiping out entire villages. When you face certain death, you will do anything. In fact, the Free Syrian Army would probably help ISIS itself and may well be doing so, because the true demon is Assad. And if we aren't committed to getting rid of Assad, ISIS will continue to grow, because ISIS is less dangerous to Syrians than Assad. I'm going to repeat that. It's important. Yes, ISIS is brutal. Yes, ISIS has beheaded 2 Americans and 1 Briton, and probably and almost certainly killed thousands of people. But Assad has murdered 200,000 people, and he's on track to murder 100,000 more this time next year. He kills about 100,000 a year, men, women, and children. What's the difference between 2 Americans and 200,000 Syrians? A lot if you're Syrian. Even if ISIS has killed 10,000, Assad has killed 20 times that amount. ISIS exists because Assad exists. ISIS exists because the Iraqi government was a Shia government. And if we just defeat ISIS, we'll be helping Assad, we'll be helping Iran, we'll be helping Russia, we'll be helping Shia terrorists in Iraq, and will do nothing to actually fix the underlying problem that causes ISIS to exist in the first place. You've got to give people hope. So if the Iraqi Sunnis see that they're going to have a future as part of the Iraqi government, or maybe even a country of their own, which is fine with me. Iraq probably should have been three countries years ago: Kurdistan, Sunni Iraq, and Shia Iraq. And you let the Syrians know that Assad is gone, and we're going to help the Free Syrian Army. If you give them a future, ISIS melts away. The Vietnamese largely won their war because they could see no future with the United States there, because we were honestly killing more people there than the Viet Cong was killing Vietnamese. In the South, they saw a future because they actually had kinship with the North. They saw they couldn't win the war after Sherman's March to the Sea, and they sued for peace. And frankly, they were given a very generous offer. Ulysses Grant told the Robert E. Lee's men they could even take home their guns and go back hunting again. But they have to see a future. I would argue even the Nazis of World War II, that the Germans largely gave up because, number one, they were defeated with overwhelming force. Number two, they could see a future for Germany because the Americans were relatively kind to the German POWs. And number three, the fanatics, the Nazis, the true believers and the psychopaths and so forth, largely were killed or outnumbered. It doesn't mean that there aren't always going to be psychopaths and fanatics there. But when you give in to them, they succeed. That's why I'm very scared about Ukraine right now, because I think that with the West deserting Ukraine, largely, that's why Poroshenko has to give in to them. Let's go to a caller, John from Seaside, California, on line one. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm fine, Mark. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you fine. How do you like my history lesson for today?
Oh, yeah. You know, I just wanted to chime in on something. I think I'm missing something, or I'm just kind of wondering. Back in 2013, when there were these attacks on the Sunnis in Syria, chemical attacks, the timeline I remember is of all the giving a warning in November 2012, and then there were some small attacks a few weeks later. And then the UN team arrived in June, and then 4 days after they get there, there's a major attack. And then we had John Kerry on the television telling us that we have absolute proof that the Assad regime did it. He won't tell us what the proof is. Later, a couple of UN reports come out. I believe they were conducted by...
John, we're running out of time. Can you get to your point, please?
So, yeah, my point is I've never seen any conclusive proof that the Assad regime carried out those attacks. And
easy proof. You want the easy proof? Assad basically had all the chemical weapons stocks and turned them over. And there's no denial about that. No one disputes it. The United Nations doesn't dispute it. Even Assad doesn't dispute it. Russia doesn't dispute it. No one disputes it. In fact, Assad is continuing to use chemical weapons, a different kind of chemical. Now he's using chlorine gas, which isn't specifically prohibited. But that specifically isn't an issue. Thank you for your call. I only got about 30 seconds left. Let me end by saying this. The will to fight is very important. And we have to understand where people's will comes from. And the best way to defeat ISIS is to give people hope for the future. To recognize that armed defeat is not a solution, that they will never win through force of arms. That's why I really think that Russia shouldn't be rewarded for invading Ukraine either. That's my take on the world 150 years after the Civil War. We can talk more about it tomorrow if you want. I'll be on the first hour tomorrow. Now we've got the Talk Radio News Service. Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. We got Bob Ney from the Talk Radio News Service on line one. Hey, Bob, how are you?
You?
Tell me why we're sending the military to Africa. Why aren't we sending a whole bunch of doctors instead?
Well, you know, we're sending it's kind of a little bit of a mystery. Frankly, Mark, it took the Washington Press Corps by surprise. Announcement of 3,000-some military troops, American, that are headed to Africa. It's going to be a mission of... setting up some temporary hospital facilities, basically a door-to-door delivery system will be initiated for some home health care products that they'll have to fight Ebola. But the questions that are going to begin is, you know, do we need the actual military to do this? Were there other people? Could we have used the money to basically hire in in-house people should we say from those countries? What about the United Nations?
Whatever happened to the old Peace Corps? Isn't this the perfect job for the Peace Corps?
That's interesting because only one other person has mentioned that, you and another person, because, you know, people are starting to say that. What about the Peace Corps? What about the World Health Organization? Mark, this one kind of took, again, I know, took me and others by surprise.
I'm not saying we shouldn't do anything. I'm just wondering who's the best people to do it.
That's the question.
Right, because, you know, I mean, I wonder if military troops might engender a backlash when we're actually trying to do humanitarian things here. Sometimes I think the Peace Corps is more powerful than our U.S. military, particularly when it comes to people trusting people. If you have this terrible disease, you're not going to trust much of anyone, much less some guy with a gun, you know, American. It doesn't make sense to me, but I guess we'll find out more as this is fleshed out. Tell me about this. It looks like there's going to be a congressional resolution to support the president's attack on ISIS. Is that right?
That's right. The debate in the House behind closed doors on the Republican side, do they do this in a separate vote or do they combine it with the temporary measure, you know, which is the ongoing temporary measures for a budget? And that resolution would take them up to December the 10th in funding. And so the question is, do you do a separate vote or add it to it? And a lot of Republicans and some Democrats are pushing for a separate, clear vote. Do you support, you know, what the president wants to do and give him the authority in Syria, or you don't?
Here's what I find really interesting, and I don't think I've seen any other issue like this. The polls seem to show that some 60-odd percent of Democrats and some 60-odd percent of Republicans support it. It's basically two-thirds, one-third in both parties. I can't think of a single other issue that has, you know, two-thirds support of both parties. It's a very interesting issue. I would think if there's any way they could possibly be bipartisan on this issue, they can be.
Well, you know, you have logical thinking. Unfortunately, the Congress doesn't apply thinking like yours.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Can't we be bipartisan on one issue, please? Maybe not. Maybe not. Thank you, Bob, for your report. I appreciate it. This is Mark Levine. You want to follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk. Go to my website, marklevinetalk.com. Hope you enjoyed my hour today. I'm going to be with you an hour tomorrow. Hey, I'm signing off.